Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, it's Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Market and Cafe. Gateway brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. Check out Gateway Market and Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Joe's got 23 years in the real estate business. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. All right, later in the program, we'll be talking about the war in Gaza and the West Bank's devastation of farming there with Iowa farmer Lee Tesdall. We'll also talk with infectious disease physician Dr. Mark Allen Derry about how RFK Jr.'s vaccine changes are being impacted and what effect they might have on a broader agenda. And then Kathy will join me. We'll be talking about how cities are benefiting from urban agriculture. But first, I'm delighted to welcome to the program Helen Schrader. She and I literally an hour before we're recording this conversation, we were at a Trump rally. And, one of us did not behave well. And it wasn't Helen.
The other one of us filmed.
The other one of us. Helen, this is the second time you and I have been at a Trump rally. And we met at the we met last July.
At a Trump rally on state fairgrounds.
Right, yep. When it was too hot. Today it was too cold.
Way too hot, too cold.
And we didn't know each other. We just bumped into each other and realized, hey, we're on the same page here.
We're on the same team.
We're not buying this Kool-Aid. We're not drinking this stuff. And today, it was a lot. We met at 11 o'clock to kind of go over the plan. And the plan basically came down to Kathy designing a shirt for me, a white shirt, with big red letters saying liar.
Unfortunately, not on the back where people
I probably would have got thrown out more quickly, but we were there, we got there in time to get good seats.
Yeah.
And it was 4 hours of listening to, pretty good music.
A little too loud.
A little too loud.
Pretty good music.
I'm glad I had earplugs. But, and some horrible speeches.
And some horrible speeches.
And then Trump came on board.
And then it was another horrible speech, yeah.
And you were busy taking photos of stuff and me. And I kept my shirt concealed until Trump started speaking. And it was, less than 5 minutes before?
Oh, that guy nailed you, yeah.
Well, he knew. This is the problem with being well-known in Des Moines. You can't get away with this stuff very well, right? So he looked at me from across from down the aisle, and he pointed to his eyes with two fingers, then he pointed those two fingers at me, and I said, and he was saying, I'm watching you.
Maybe next time I'll wear the shirt. You can have the camera.
Okay. Well, yeah. Did anybody ever figure out that you and I were connected?
I don't think so. Even while I was taking your picture.
Yeah. I was thinking, I'm not going to unveil the liar shirt until he starts lying, but it took all 10 seconds.
It didn't take very long.
It is appalling to see the abandonment of truth that has taken hold of this presidency, but then have been believed by so many people.
Yeah. They don't seem stupid until he starts talking, and then.
the people. I was sitting next to a very nice gal from Cedar Rapids, and people. Everybody around me was. They were nice people.
They were nice people.
And how about
you? Nice.
You're on the other
nice.
Side of the aisle.
I was not actually.
Well,
the
other
side of the aisle.
Physically on the other side of the aisle, same side of the rally. Yeah.
Yes.
But what were your peeps like over there?
Oh, they were polite. We kept excusing each other, going to get right. various condiments and drinks and things like that.
Because we had to sit there for 4 hours.
Something like that.
More than that, even. Yeah, more than four hours.
He was an hour late talking,
I don't know. I don't know how somebody can think that that's appropriate to be that late, you know?
He must have had a good conversation going at the machine shed. Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, he's not, it's not just that. I've known, you know who was really, really prompt? President George W. Bush. Mm. Always on time. Mm. You know, it was absolutely terrible. The worst, actually. Worse than Trump. John Edwards. He was terrible. He would leave people sitting out in hot conditions with no shade for like an hour, hour and a half.
Oh, my goodness. You know? Anyway. Yeah.
So, I mean, what's your vibe on the event? Other than the fact that the people around us seem decent, nice.
Everybody seemed nice. There were some other concealed protesters after you were drug out.
Tell us about those.
There was a child that was very emphatically telling a story of some sort.
A child, like how old?
Like, it sounded like about five, and I couldn't see the person either. It
really?
Seemed to be a short, small, young person. And then after that...
You couldn't tell what they were saying, though. Huh?
I could not tell what they were saying, but they were saying it adamantly, so the people around them could certainly hear. And they were silenced pretty quickly.
Okay.
And then after that, there was a more organized, several people, front and center, and I think they had firecrackers, or one of them did.
Oh,
there was an actual firecracker that went off.
That went off?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
That's a bad idea.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's a bad idea.
That can turn a police officer frightened real quick.
Yeah. Turn anybody frightened, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that seems like a really horrible idea.
Yeah, I thought so as well. I was standing by the exit at that point, right next to the Secret Service, waiting for the ability to leave, because once they took you out, no one could leave.
Sorry.
Everyone was stuck.
Sorry. Yeah. So I kind of want... And so after those... protesters who lit off a firework.
It was some sort of firecracker. I'm not sure it was a firework. It was something, you know, explosive in nature that went off. Yes.
So that made me, I don't know whether it's because I was removed. How long after my removal did that happen?
The child was just a few minutes, and then I tried to leave because you had called.
Right.
And then as I was standing by the Secret Service woman waiting for the ability to leave, the more organized group in the front and center, but they were quickly drowned out by USA, USA. Mm-hmm. So I don't even think Mr. Trump had a chance to heckle back, as is his wont.
I have been heckled back by Trump at a rally before. Mm-hmm. This is my fourth Trump rally.
My second, I guess.
Didn't quite make it into one. No, actually, it's my fifth Trump rally.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Thrown out of two, arrested at one, but... I think, you know, it's protest is really important. And, you know, I didn't want to argue too much with the guy who he said to me, what does your shirt say? So it says liar. He says, is that about the president? I say, yes. He says, you've got to leave. I say, well, there's nothing in the he give you a list of prohibited items.
They gave us a list. Yeah.
And there's nothing saying
T-shirts wasn't on it.
You know, T-shirts with inappropriate message. I tried to reason with him a little bit, saying, you know, it's not. You know, I mean, it's my right to have, be able to say what I want to say.
Wear clothing.
He goes, and he was adamant, and I knew I wasn't going to win that one.
No, he was
especially
a big guy.
With him and like four or five other officers around.
And then
him.
There were those officers.
I wasn't going to argue with him. I didn't want to risk arrest.
Yeah.
I said, okay, I'll go, but let me get my stuff, okay? And they did. Mm. And they let me put it on. But yeah, once
and
I got
they
outside,
trapped the rest of us in
there. Yeah, I saw two other people trying to leave. As I was going out the door, and they wouldn't allow them to leave.
Yeah.
And you were stuck in that same
boat. They probably needed to secure the perimeter.
So you left before Trump was finished speaking.
Absolutely. So. I did not need to hear more of that.
Well, I wonder how many other protests occurred.
I wonder as well. I do.
There were protests outside as well, and I didn't get a good view.
My sister was actually out there, Sarah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And do you know much about what happened outside?
I don't. I know that once I left, they had already gone home. I did call her and say, you know, are you cold? Do you need a break? Should I bring my warm car?
Yeah.
She said, no, we're already home. So.
Yeah. I mean, it was tough enough to sit there. I mean, I'd have earplugs. The music was so loud.
Yeah.
And I sat, we
I'm
sat.
Younger. My ears liked it.
Your ears have probably already had more damage than mine. I'm very careful with my ears.
That's probably it.
But, I mean, to be outside, I mean, this isn't terrible weather. It's, what, 20 degrees today?
That's not Minnesota.
It's not 20 below.
But
it's bad enough. So I admire the people who were outside expressing their concerns about our the direction of our country. I don't think the firecracker is a good idea.
No, I don't think so either. When I heard it go off, I sort of looked that direction and I thought, oh my gosh, what is that? And how did it get through security?
Yeah, how did it get through security?
Which I'm sure is exactly what the Secret Service and the police officers
were thinking. Because we went through two different security checkpoints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had me open my jacket.
They had us walk through a metal detector.
I opened my jacket, and underneath my jacket is a flannel shirt. Mm-hmm. Underneath my flannel shirt is the
protest
T-shirt that says liar on it. But, yeah. I think what's happening right now in terms of resistance to the Trump administration and its policies is very important, very effective. I think it weakens the case against him when we have incidents like the firecracker.
Yes, I believe so. I think that was a bad idea.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also thinking that one reason Trump is in Iowa, well, it's close to Minnesota, without actually having to go there.
Having to go to Minnesota, he's close to Minnesota.
But also, Iowa is going to be
caucuses are coming up.
There are Republican caucuses still.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there will be little known fact to most of the universe. There is an off-year caucus.
Yes, there is.
Every 4 years is the big one that gets all the attention, now only for Republicans, no longer for Democrats.
Some of the circling politicians were encouraging people to be
right
to go to the caucus and be
yes,
delegates.
And I one guy running for governor came up to me and said, "Hello, Ed, what are you doing here?"
I said, just wait and see.
I said, "Well, I came to see you, Eddie." He didn't believe
perfect.
It, but no, he said to me, you know, he was with a gal who's running for the state house, and he said, you know, one thing I want to say this about Ed, when you ran for governor and when you were lawmaker, whatever you said, I knew was what you really believed. You know, I really, really appreciate it. I thought that was a high compliment from
a
Republican running for governor, but
that's a compliment.
I think that's a way of being that everybody in politics should endorse. You know?
I agree.
Unfortunately, I didn't hear a lot of that from the speakers.
No.
It was our three of our four Congress members, and then Trump came on.
Mm.
And again, in terms of who was the most disingenuous, yeah, Trump, hands down. But again, I think one reason he's here is because Iowa has at least two, maybe three competitive districts.
Yeah.
We have a fair redistricting situation, a system.
So far,
yeah. and I think it means that we have three districts that could be competitive.
Good to know.
So you can't wait to go to your next Trump rally, Helen?
I cannot wait to see that man again.
Yeah. Have you been to Minnesota? I'm curious. A lot of Iowans have gone up to stand with our friends in Minnesota.
I have as a tourist, mostly.
Oh, but
I do have friends.
But not recently with the
No,
protests.
Not yeah. recently. No, I'm yeah. actually afraid.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Yeah. Do you have friends up there who've been involved with the...
I have friends who have to live up there, and they talk about the situation being a little tense and not at all normal, and please don't discard what's happening here. It's really as bad as you think it is.
Mm. Yeah. And now it seems they moved on to Portland, Maine, and who knows what may happen next. But I wouldn't be surprised to see more of a nice presence in Des Moines at some point, but... We may not get the Minneapolis treatment, but...
We're a red state.
Yeah. So, yeah, anyway, I really appreciate you coming with me. I got to be honest, it was hard for me to talk anybody into joining me. Hey, you want to go to a Trump rally with me today?
I'm the sucker that got talked into it.
No, it's a good thing to do. I mean, I don't know what comes of it. It's a small statement.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the truth is, if we'd been there about a half hour earlier... And we had not been me, who is too well known.
Yeah. Next time I wear the shirt.
Okay, next time you wear the shirt. People were being invited up on stage behind Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So envision four or five people on stage. I mean, you've got to applaud when all the other speakers are coming up. You've got to do all the stuff. But then when the moment comes, you bear the liar shirt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to close with this. This is from Robert Reich. He's in a coffee shop in New Hampshire, and a guy walks up to him and says, "I've been a lifelong Republican, but the events of the past weeks have caused me to leave the Republican Party." "I'm happy to hear that," I said with a smile and turned to finish my breakfast. "I'm from New Hampshire," the guy said, "and many of my Republican friends are leaving the party too. Minneapolis was the last straw. Reich says, I put down my fork and turned toward him. I assume you're talking about the behavior of ICE and Border Patrol agents there and the killings? No, all terrible, of course, the man says. But what really finished me were the lies. Noam, Miller, Bovino, Vance, Trump, he frowned. They all lied through their teeth. I saw the video. They're a pack of liars. I think the shirt was a good one.
Yep.
Maybe we'll have to wear it again.
Yeah.
Helen, thanks for joining me.
Absolutely.
Back, folks, in a couple minutes with more conversation for you on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Hey, thanks to our sponsors and our partners, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Westrum Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrum and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry. Well, I'd like to welcome to the program Lee Tesdall. He's an Iowa farmer with connections to Gaza and the West Bank. Lee, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Ed.
So tell us about your farming experience here in Iowa. You come from a long stock of farmers.
Yeah, both my grandfathers and grandmothers started out as farmers. One near Ackworth, Iowa. That's on my mother's side in a Quaker community there.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't farm for very long. He went to find greener pastures, I guess. And
what possible greener pastures are there than farmland?
That's a good question. He became a teacher, so he probably made even less money. But and then on my father's side, that's where I live now, in northern Polk County. And they came from a line of they were Norwegian immigrants to northern Polk County.
Yeah. So and you raise sheep and kernza. We've talked about kernza on this program. It's a perennial weed.
Right.
What else do you raise besides those two crops? Is there something else?
Well, on my 80-acre farm, as you said, I have kernza, 7 acres of kernza, 5 acres of hay for my sheep.
Sure.
We bale that every summer. And then I rent out 50 acres for row crop corn soy production to a neighbor. So I get cash rent for that. And then I have 3 acres of prairie strips.
Hmm.
And I have about 8 acres of perennial buffer strips along the creek and a waterway.
And the sheep.
And the sheep.
And they're guarded by a llama.
They're guarded by Lenny the Llama.
Lenny with two L's.
with
should be Yenny the Llama.
Yenny the Llama, yeah, that's right, yeah.
So what's your connection to Palestine?
Well, going back, I guess going way back, I think we came out of Africa through Palestine, probably. But because Gaza and Palestine lie right along the Levant Trail, whereby African modern humans coming out of Africa moved northwards. So, but that's a long time ago.
Yeah, I don't want to go back that far. What's your own historical?
So, in 1914, my maternal grandfather, who was a professor at William Penn College, had gone to Germany to study, but then also had taken a Holy Land trip. So just before the First World War started, he was trekking around and actually walked through parts of Palestine, took a train on north into Syria. So I have his diary, and I read about his trip. That's the first direct family connection. And then later, 1949, my parents embarked from New York City to Alexandria, Egypt, on the Muhammad Ali Kabir ship, that was his title, to work as Quaker humanitarian workers in Gaza.
Okay.
And so, and then later I went back to teach English in Amman, Jordan, visited Gaza at the invitation
So you went to teach, yeah.
Right, in Jordan, right.
And you married a Palestinian woman,
right? Yeah. My wife was from Lida, yeah.
And I believe she passed away.
Right, correct, yeah.
But your kids are, you know, part whatever you are from European descent.
Right.
And the other half of Palestinian descent.
Correct.
So you got a pretty strong connection there.
Yeah, pretty strong.
Yeah.
Very strong.
Yeah, very strong. And your two sons both live over in that part of the world.
Right.
Yeah. So what do you know about farming in both Gaza and the West Bank?
Right. So my wife was not from a peasant or farming background. They were from a town background. Her grandfather and her father started out as selling shoes and repairing shoes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, living there, I learned quite a lot about agriculture as I went along. I remember the photograph of the almond orchard when I went to visit my student in Gaza in 1977. In the background, there's an almond orchard blooming in December.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I noticed the crops that were being exported. And I would go shopping, and I'm on Jordan, and I would see some of the produce that came from Gaza or the West Bank in the markets in Jordan.
And these are crops, almond trees, raised by Palestinian families.
Right, at that time, yeah.
And that was back in the 90s, 80s?
That was 77.
70s, wow.
It was winter break.
Okay.
I remember he invited me to visit winter break. At that time, you could still take a taxi across the Allenby Bridge up to Jerusalem, and you'd get a taxi into Gaza. Of course, that's all gone now.
I was in Israel about the same time, 1978 or 9.
There we go.
That's another story, though. We'll save that for another day.
Let's do another program.
I mean, I think everybody is aware of how much devastation has occurred in Gaza, no matter what side of the conversation you're on.
Right.
And I think everything I've been seeing is that the agricultural devastation is as bad as any of the destruction that's happening. I mean,
right.
It wasn't just the Israeli Defense Forces going after the cities or military strongholds of Hamas. They were destroying the food production as well.
Right. I think that's true. I think I have a number here. 86% of Gaza's cultivated agricultural land has been severely damaged. And as of July 2025, only 1.5% of land in the strip remained accessible in Arable.
1.5%,
yeah.
Okay.
So prior to October 7, you know, they were producing quite a lot of local food.
Right.
Gaza's pretty small, the Gaza Strip. It's actually a quarter the size of Polk County with more than four times the population. So
right. It's 25% the size of one Iowa county with four times as many people.
The one that were the county.
And this is the most populous county in the state too. So that's
it is. Yeah.
That's a lot of people. I mean,
right.
What, 2 million people live in the Gaza Strip or lived in the Gaza Strip?
Yeah, two or a little more. Yeah. So when my parents were there in 49-50, the AFSC, the Quakers, did a kind of informal survey. They think there were about 200,000 refugees. Now Gaza was a place since time immemorial, so there were people, there were Gazans living there, but then 200,000 new people moved in after 48 because they were expelled from farther north.
Oh, 200,000 additional Palestinians.
Right. So those were the refugees.
They were expelled from what became the State of Israel.
Correct. Right. And so those were the people that my parents were, the Quakers were helping.
Okay. Yeah. So the state of agriculture, I mean, when 90-something percent of your farmland is destroyed, their livelihoods are destroyed as well. There were people who made a living as farmers. What has happened to them?
Right. Well, you know, they're living in tents along the coast or wherever.
They're not farming.
They're not farming. It would be my guess that being very resourceful, that there are little plots here and there of mint and arugula that you and I both grow, and a few cukes and a little couple of tomatoes here and there, but and maybe some rabbits and maybe some chickens here and there, but yeah, most of it's gone.
So they're growing food for their own consumption to the extent that
people
they can.
Are trying. Yeah.
So what about the wonderful peace plan that Trump has come up with that basically divides the Gaza Strip, gives a big chunk of it to Israel, and leaves a fraction of the original strip in its place? What about that? How, I mean, beyond agriculture, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, my thoughts are that the people there are resilient, and that whatever plans get cooked up overseas without the input of indigenous people, by the way, will probably fall by the wayside at some point. I can't imagine that those grandiose plans actually happening. Mm-hmm. I certainly hope they won't. Most Arab countries will refuse to take Palestinian refugees from Gaza. They've been refugees for 76 years, right, in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And most of them came from somewhere else, and they'll just refuse to move, I think. So I think whatever you know, Mr. Kushner and the others come up with, I think it's going to flame out and go away. Gaza is an ancient place. I mean, some of our basic food materials, you know, came out of the Fertile Crescent, right? Mm-hmm. Wheat, barley, lentils, these crops, and it's an ancient place with resilient people. And I just don't see the skyscrapers and the resorts happening that some folks...
Trump Gaza. Right, yeah, right. So in terms of, I mean, agriculture, the other portion of the Palestinian homeland that still exists, at least on paper, is the West Bank. We know that Israeli settlers continue to incur into the West Bank and set up their own towns and their own houses, and taking Palestinian land to do that. But how is that affecting agriculture specifically in the West Bank?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So, and by the way, there are also there are about 2 million Palestinians who are...
In Israel.
Who are citizens of Israel.
Who,
by the way, don't have all the rights that a Jewish Israeli would have, but that's another discussion. But one thing we see is settlers coming in and destroying olive trees.
In addition to just building houses, they're destroying...
Right, in areas where, you know, olive... and, you know, all of us enjoy the Palestinian olive oil, right, that comes out of the Jenin area. But so that's one direct thing. Another thing they've been doing is bringing in their own herds of sheep and goats to go through fields and crops. Palestinian fields and crops to, you know, damage them and destroy them. So that's another thing that's been happening.
And you, a reasonable person would ask, well, how are they getting away with that?
Right.
What should be in place to stop them? I mean, the international law, you know, the international community has said that these settlements are illegal.
Right.
And Israel, the state of Israel, has, you know, maybe occasionally paid lip service to that recognition, but for the most part has done nothing to stop it.
Right.
Is that fair?
It looks that way. I mean, one of the things that we say is that the U.S. Congress, you know, is occupied by the state of Israel, essentially. So there's, you know, United States of America is really the only power that could make a big difference, I think, in Israeli policy. that our U.S. Congress is basically, for a number of reasons, very much in tune with the Zionist objectives in Palestine. And it's been that way for a long time, since Harry Truman.
Since Harry Truman.
Mm-hmm. And, well, it wasn't as severe in those days. Mm-hmm. There was probably more European support for Zionism in the 50s and working in the 60s.
And again, Zionism being not just the existence of Israeli people in that region, but the confiscation of other people's land in order to expand the
right.
the state.
We usually define it as political Judaism. I mean, that's a simple definition.
Right.
But the idea was, and of course there are various flavors of Zionism over the years, but basically that Palestine should be a homeland for Jews, in which the Jewish population would have precedent over the indigenous population in rights and so on.
Because we all can't get along?
Well,
we should be able to.
We should be able to, but you know, there's that kind of messianic idea that that some Christian Zionists and Jewish Zionists hold that you know, Palestine was promised to the Jewish people, and so that's where some of the folks are coming from.
So the impact on the lives of farmers. I mean, there are people who are losing their livelihood, but also losing their land. And are there international groups that are getting involved in some way that express solidarity with the farm community? I mean, farmers of any nationality in any situation where there's war and turmoil and oppression and imperialism, you know, they ought to be defended.
Right.
And is there anyone rising to their defense?
Yes, there are people. There are Israelis. I just watched a video this morning of a group of rabbis who were coming out to Palestinian land to plant new olive trees on Palestinian land. So there are Israelis who get it, and there are international groups also. Who are coming in to the West Bank to stand with Palestinian villagers and peasants to witness the Israeli settlers' attacks and, you know, film video and try to defend the Palestinians.
Yeah, and so. Well, that's encouraging. I mean, maybe the most obvious solution is eventually a political one where the current government is replaced by one that is more moderate, more progressive, more willing to work with the international community and Israel's neighbors to recognize the importance of some settlement that's just for everybody.
Right. Yeah. I was just listening to a lecture by Dr. Ilan Pappé. Who actually teaches at University of Exeter in England. He's Israeli. And his idea is there has to be a one-state solution.
Yeah. And I think everybody who's objective about this has moved beyond the notion of a possible two-state solution.
Right. Bit of a joke.
Well, Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Lee Testel, Iowa farmer with some deep connections in Palestine. When we come back from a short break, we'll be talking with Dr. Mark Allen Derry, an HIA infectious disease physician, about his take on the RFK Jr.'s revisions of vaccine recommendations. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asked that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. I would like to welcome Dr. Mark Allen Derry to the program. Mark Allen, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Ed.
Yeah. Mark Allen is an infectious disease physician in New Orleans. He also owns a radio station, which I'm so impressed with that. Anyway, we want to talk about the new vaccine mandate that came out a little while ago under the authorship of RFK Jr. And there has been a lot of criticism, and some of it from informed sources, some of it just from concerns of, you know, people on the street. But I thought getting your take on it as an infectious disease physician would be really helpful. What are your thoughts, Mark Allen?
So what essentially happened, and we saw a little bit more movement just in the last couple of days, just when they're talking about polio vaccine. So we'll put a pin in that, and I'm going to circle back to that vaccine in a moment. But essentially, because of the largesse of the U.S. and the unevenness of the healthcare system, especially the delivery of the healthcare system, we public health practitioners, infectious disease doctors, pediatricians, we've always kind of opted or practiced in the sense of we're going to try to prevent as many potential illnesses as possible. And this is why the newborn vaccine schedule has more vaccines, let's say, than the country they were referring to, which was Denmark, in which has far less childhood vaccines. And that's largely because it's a much more of a homogenous society. In other words, people's access to healthcare system is much, much better than ours. They just don't have the same healthcare problems. Certainly when we talk about social determinants of health, poverty, lack of education, things that could impact people's health care later, those things aren't there because of their high quality and their high standard of living. So what essentially RFK and his group of non-infectious disease and public health scientists, they may be doctors or have PhDs and they may be scientists of some sort, but certainly nowhere in the mainstream of what we refer to as science. Certainly what we refer to as wing nuts, let's just say, or people who just are not in the mainstream of science. So what they essentially do is they are recommending a new schedule in which various vaccines have been eliminated. That is hepatitis A, and we can talk about these in a moment, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, rotavirus, meningococcal virus, and I think off the top, hepatitis A, B, rotavirus, meningococcus, and there's another one or two that they're also recommending. Now, the reason why this is an issue and why this is a bad issue is that, for example, hepatitis B, which is something that's oftentimes transmitted from mother to child, in the U.S. that can be transmitted just even through a couple drops of blood. So you could be at a child care, and if somebody's bleeding, there could be some transmission of blood or what have you. And it has saved about 30,000 cases of hepatitis B, which could lead to liver failure, liver cancer, and then ultimately death. So even though the numbers are small, when we talk about the large, you know, 330 million people, 30,000 may seem small. But when we're talking about saving the life of children, this is an incredibly important function. The rotavirus vaccine, for example, is also the virus that causes just immense vomiting. Oh, I remember COVID and RSV, and flu. Okay, we'll talk about those in a second.
Yeah, yeah.
So the rotavirus vaccine is a virus that causes GI, you know, sickness. This is, you may eat something, you know, somewhere, and then 2 days later you have intractable nausea, vomiting, and then it persists for a couple of days.
Been there, done that.
In children, this could lead to significant dehydration and ultimately death. So the fact that they remove that, again, it doesn't make sense. These are vaccines that are there to help children.
So
RSV vaccine, which prevents children from getting the RSV virus, which also could lead to respiratory issues, put them in a hospital and potentially die as well. So you could see these are vaccines that have been scientifically shown to be appropriately placed on the vaccine schedule. And moreover, every single professional entity, including mine, the one I belong to, Infectious Disease Society of America, but every professional entity has rejected those recommendations and have asked pediatricians to continue the previous recommendations as they stood before RFK got involved.
So if it doesn't make sense scientifically, how do we explain it? Why are they doing this?
Well, what we are seeing is what COVID showed us very, very clearly was that the public health infrastructure is something that we have been talking as public health practitioners has been very, very threadbare to begin with. Unfortunately, a lot of money goes into it. It's completely disjointed. There's hundreds and hundreds of public health departments that are all across the country that are completely disjointed and not connected to one another. I mean, we learned during COVID, they still use faxing, right? They still needed paper charts. I mean, this is how, unfortunately, sometimes our public health system is been. The investments have been very poor.
Right.
But since we have seen RFK coming in and the decisions that have been made, I mean, one of the decisions that they decided to do was stop following H5N1. That's the bird flu virus that can cause significant death. And we've seen some cases of death here in the U.S., certainly around the world. Since 2002, 2003, since we've been following bird flu, there's been like the mortality rate is 50, that's 50%. And we just stopped following it. One of the decisions that got made was to stop putting investment into the research, into the mRNA vaccine that can save people's lives if we do see a bird flu outbreak. And what we have seen is evidence that the bird flu is now mutating into other strains.
Right.
But we're not following it as a government entity. The rest of the world is looking at us and through scientific articles kind of imploring upon us to please pay attention, because what could potentially happen are outbreaks. So to answer your question, what do I think is happening? You know, in light of what we've seen in the last couple of weeks of what we've seen in Minneapolis, and, you know, what I am about to say, you know, may sound a little kind of, you know, extreme, but I really do feel very, you know, secure in my beliefs here. And I thought about it before we saw the killings of Renee Good and we saw the killings of Alex Preddy, the ICU nurse. But what we are seeing is a rapid dismantling of the public health system in such the threads that they're pulling, the pieces of the Jenga game that is the public health system are so they are so important to the structure of the system. I think they want to see what Naomi Klein, the writer, has referred to as a viral collapse. They don't mind if there could be a large H5N1 epidemic, or they don't mind if there is influenza that's transmitted and people are sick as a result of that. I think that if they are willing to show us that they are openly fine with killing citizens in the streets of Minneapolis, that I think we can use that as an analogy to see that they are okay with dismantling the public health system so that it doesn't serve us well.
So you're saying that they would be okay with an epidemic?
I think they are trying to encourage one.
And why? That's an extreme form of psychosis.
That's the easiest question to answer. Because the populace that's sick and can't be out protesting and staying at home or scared to be sick remains vulnerable and is easy to rule over.
Hmm. So chronic disease or infectious disease in this case becomes a tool of...
particularly, but the same thing when you look at reproductive rights. I mean, if you are able to keep families at home having to care for children, rather than being able to choose to have an abortion if you wanted to because you didn't feel like it was right for you or wasn't right for your family services. But again, I do believe that what we see with the elimination of reproductive rights is the same thing. I think that keeping people out of the streets or protesting because they're too scared to be out there, one, because they could be killed, two, because there are infectious diseases that are transmitting, or three, you just have kids at home that you need to make sure there's food on the table. And if you look at all elements, I mean, we're seeing the rapid dismantling of the education system, of the finance system, the banking system, the rapid dismantling of our society, I think, is really largely intended to make, I think, ultimately it difficult to have an election in the midterms and then ultimately in 2 years after that. So, yes, I really do believe that we are seeing this rapid dismantling of the healthcare system by some of the decisions that are getting made, and just so that they could continually see people sick.
And so, you know,
rather than being healthy.
Somebody like Stephen Miller, I could see him subscribing to all kinds of horrible, horrible tactics in order to gain this sense of political and economic superiority. Is RFK really in on that, or is he just a dupe who's being played by these powers to make these recommendations that play into that bigger scenario?
It's an impossible question to answer.
I know.
I think that power corrupts, you know, and it corrupts powerfully. You know, I think that RFK just is in a position to, I'll just for a quick second, I'll bite. I think he never was what his father and uncles were. I think maybe he really wanted to be that impactful and influential of a person. And had he stopped 10 or 15 years ago, he would have succeeded as a great career as an environmental scientist or attorney, rather, and did good work, right, mm-hmm. in New York.
Yeah.
But I think he wanted to have a greater impact. And I think that he just basically flipped sides, joined the dark forces. And he is having, and he will have a tremendous impact. I don't know how much time we have. If I have another minute, let me explain to you another thing that they recently are doing by pulling out of the WHO, which just happened a couple days ago.
That's the World Health Organization.
The World Health Organization. Let me tell you why that's important. Well, last year, RFK completely dismantled the ACIP, which is the Committee on Immunization Practices, okay? And that had 17 amazing infectious disease doctors, epidemiologists. These were the top of the top of the top, right? And they were the ones that created the flu vaccine, amongst other things. They were the ones that created the ingredients that went into the flu vaccine every year. Well, this year, they used a different group. They fired everybody. They got this new group of quacks that we see now. We're seeing all these ridiculous recommendations that they're making. But last year, what they did was they just took the recipe from the WHO. They basically took what the WHO was going to do, and that's what we're using this year. We see the vaccine is very good. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a new virus kind of emerged out of nowhere that we're kind of dealing with, but whatever. Now that we have stepped away from the WHO, we are no longer going to be sharing information back and forth. And so I don't know how in the next couple of weeks, because usually the vaccine is the ingredients, the various strains that they put into the annual vaccine starts getting prepared between January and February. Hmm. Now that we've pulled out of the WHO, I don't know what we're going to do for the flu vaccine for next year. And again, if it doesn't end up being a really good one, I believe that they are very much like, oh, well, you know, we tried, rather than really putting their, you know, their all into it.
Well, one final question, Mark Allen, just to be really clear about this. The vaccines that we're talking about, rotavirus, influenza, COVID, I believe, hepatitis A and B, and they're not being outlawed, of course. They're really shifting the categorization of those vaccines as recommended to not recommended, correct? I mean, people can still get them?
Yes. Yes. So the fear was that if it didn't come from that recommendation, that the insurance companies would stop paying for them. And that still may be come to pass. As of right now, the recommendations from all medical societies are to continue with the previous immunization schedule that existed prior to as it stands now. How insurance companies may respond to it later, that's difficult to kind of say. Okay. But as of right now, all we can do is encourage people to do it, because the science is very clear on this too, Ed. That's very interesting, that if kids start missing vaccines by the time that they're 2 months, that just missing 2 months is a predictor that they will then down the line be missing a lot of their vaccines, and they'll be poorly vaccinated. Yeah. So just trying to make sure you get all the vaccines on schedule as it has been previously recommended is very important, because again, if you are not vaccinated by 2 months, that is a predictor that you will be poorly, that your child will be poorly vaccinated.
Well,
I think that they know that, and they're trying to get people to that so that they will ultimately be poorly vaccinated.
Dr. Derry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Folks, we've been talking with Mark Allen Derry, an infectious disease physician in New Orleans, Louisiana. Back in a minute with more conversation for you on the Fallon Forum. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Hey, good to have you back with me on the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon, your host. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact DavidDrakeFamilyPsychiatry.com. Hey, it's farm and food time, and with me to have that conversation, Kathy Burns.
Once again,
and we're looking at the benefits to cities and towns of allowing agriculture inside the city limits.
Yep, allowing it, and if you already have it, increasing it. Saw an article in ScienceDirect.com called Urban Agriculture, a Strategic Pathway to Building Resilience and Enduring Sustainable Food Security in Cities. Had some great segmented pieces of information. I thought we could give some examples of benefits to cities.
Yeah, and we certainly have our own list from our urban farming ventures here in Des Moines' oldest neighborhood, Sherman Hill. And but I know this research is good because it looks all over the world and comes up with a whole bunch of things. Some of them we never even thought of.
Right.
Yeah.
The first benefit to cities, might come out of the blue to some people is water management. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they estimate in 2012 that more than 40% of our global population, in 2012, they estimated that more than 40% of the population by the year 2050 will be located in water-stressed areas.
I would argue that it's probably happening more quickly.
Yes.
And already we're getting really close to that.
Yeah, that study is quite old, and I'm sure that we are, that would be upped a little bit. But considering that large-scale agriculture, you know, traditional farming.
Conventional.
You know, rural stuff.
Conventional farming.
Uses about 70% of global fresh water.
Wow.
We can look to urban agriculture because it is increasingly using targeted irrigation, circular systems. They collect and reuse water to grow crops, and saving water. An example of that is in an Indian city where the use of drip irrigation resulted in water savings of up to 60%. That's one example.
I see that. I'm Edabad, and I was there.
I wondered if you were familiar.
Yeah, I stayed with Mrs. Kulkarni there for a few days when I was studying Gandhi's activities in India, which is good timing for this week's program.
Sure.
Because this is the January 30th is the anniversary of Gandhi's assassination.
I didn't know that we were going to have this all in such a tiny little package.
Well, I know. But, I mean, we know, you know, we obviously use city water to irrigate our crops here.
Yes.
But we also have a rain barrel,
two rain barrels.
And the rain barrels provide quite a bit. I mean, I don't know how many thousands of gallons of water we get from our rain barrels a year. It's a lot. But then we also use mulch.
Yes.
Mulch is key in helping to preserve moisture content and reducing
right.
the amount of water you need to apply.
Mm-hmm. Well, waste management is another biggie, and we're very familiar with this example because the stats show that a backyard chicken is expected to consume about 1.6 pounds of food scraps per week. Yearly, that one chicken then we'll be taking care of 83 pounds of waste that would normally go into the city waste system.
Yeah, at a cost to taxpayers and also the landfill capacity.
And if you only have a flock of six birds, that's 500 pounds of waste kept out of the systems per year.
Yeah.
So multiply that by more and more backyard chickens, which we are always fans of. You've got a lot of waste reduction in your city.
Yeah. We take leaves from our yard, and we throw them in the chicken coop for bedding.
Yes.
That's one more thing that doesn't end up in the waste stream.
Does not, yeah. So much good. Emissions management. The urban trees, and if those are fruit trees, I think all the better. Ed, you might feel the same.
Oh, yeah.
they are known to absorb about 711,000 metric tons of air pollution per year, and I'm bad because I didn't catch where that was located. So, oops, insufficient notes on my part. But green roofs in urban areas also significantly reduce air pollutants. So we've got emissions management going on.
One thing too,
I
say, trees in urban neighborhoods also add value to properties.
They do.
Yeah,
they do.
If you're just thinking about money, there's an issue there as well.
Well, and if we would get, I don't think we're going to get to the economic benefits category, but that is, you know, the land value is one of the benefits of urban gardening too.
Yeah, another point in this study I see is that, you know, reducing transportation costs of hauling food from elsewhere around the world.
Mm-hmm.
If you're growing it in your city, there's very, very little transportation cost.
That's right.
If you're growing it in your backyard, there's none. You know?
I kind of like the social well-being category because when we look at issues like housing and violence, people often say, well, we need more social and personal well-being. Urban ag can play a role in that, but it enhances social interactions.
Yeah, for example, we had a 7-year-old girl come by here the other day on her birthday, and we said, oh, you want to see our animals? And she came back and she saw our two new baby rabbits and she asked if she could name them.
Yes.
Well, she asked first what their names were. I said, none, but you get to name them. It's your birthday.
So. And then she helped us make butter.
Yeah.
We do not have our own milk cow, which is too bad, but she helped us make butter.
all kinds of good reasons why we got to be encouraging more urban agriculture. And Des Moines, ideally,
should be
the local food capital of the U.S.
Hooray.
We're already doing good stuff. Let's keep it going. Kathy, thank you for joining me. Folks, thanks to our guests today, Lee Tesdall and Mark Allen Derry. Thanks to our production team, which includes me and Kathy, and Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, and Charles Goldman. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. Finally, thanks to the Des Moines Iver Session for our bumper music. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.